This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. This week, already strained relations between Iran and the United States deteriorated further. In a triumphant, carefully staged announcement, Iran claimed that it had taken a major step toward developing nuclear fuel. While in Washington, veteran journalist Seymour Hersh reported that the White House has stepped up military planning to stop them. Though neither Iran's success at enriching uranium nor Hersh's sources can be confirmed, and the White House vehemently denies Hersh's story, the heat between Tehran and Washington continues to rise. This morning, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said that Iran's assertion will require strong steps from the United Nations Security Council. If Iran has indeed enriched uranium, it raises the stakes in a war of words that some analysts fear could escalate into an actual war. And though Washington reiterated its desire for diplomacy, it still maintains that a nuclear Iran is unacceptable. So this hour, we will talk about the options for dealing with Iran. Are there any good choices? Later in the hour, we will take a very different turn from diplomatic options to spring options. How will you enrich your spring closet? But first, the diplomatic collision course with Iran. Join the conversation. Should the military option be on the table? Can the U.S. handle another conflict, given our commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And my first guest is Joseph Cerincione. He's the Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's with me here in Studio 3A. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Joe, Iran claimed yesterday that it had successfully enriched uranium, and it made a big deal out of it. I mean, it was almost like a public festival.
I've never seen a lab experiment celebrated with costumes and dancing and this kind of pageantry.
What do you make of it?
Well, they're clearly pumping this for all it's worth. This is a milestone in any program. There aren't that many countries, 10 actually, that can enrich uranium in any reasonable quantity. They didn't release the news about how much they'd been able to enrich. I suspect it's very small quantities, could be grams. They're a very long way away from the ability to either make fuel or bomb material, years, in fact.
How do you know that?
Well, because we have a very good idea of what's going on in the Iranian program. We've had IAEA inspectors there for over 3 years. Dozens of inspectors are there every day evaluating it. The U.S. has been training its intelligence and reconnaissance capabilities on the nation at least that time. It's possible there's some secret facility, but there's no evidence to indicate that. So you can calculate out in a pretty straight line, knowing where they are now. And this was no surprise. They told us they were doing this. We have IAEA inspectors there watching them do this. Where they are now, how long does it take them to get from here to a bomb? And the best estimates are that it would be about 5 to 10 years. That, in fact, is the national intelligence estimate. So our intelligence agencies making those calculations figured that if they went all out and nothing went wrong, it would take about 5 years to get the machinery up, get everything working, and be able to make the material for a bomb.
Now, this may be obvious to you, but it might not be obvious to everybody. The U.S. has a nuclear weapon, Israel has a nuclear weapon, India has a nuclear weapon, Pakistan, etc., France. Why doesn't the U.S. want Iran to have one? And why does the U.S. feel it has the right to tell Iran it can't have one?
Well, it's not just this administration. It's most people in the United States would feel very uncomfortable with a radical regime such as that in Tehran having a nuclear weapon, particularly with a government headed by a president who's threatened to wipe Israel off the map and has denied the Holocaust. Sometimes you feel like, you know, you have to take people seriously here. Would they actually use such a weapon? But it does present a real problem for the United States because we've now put ourselves in the position of picking and choosing who should have weapons or not. The president just this year made a major agreement with India that says, okay, it's okay that India has nuclear weapons. You're our friend. You're a democracy. We like you, but it's not okay for Iran to have nuclear weapons. It presents some obvious double standard problems that I don't think can be sustained. There has to be one rule for everybody. That's the only way you can deal with issues like nuclear weapons. That's the way it's worked for chemical and biological weapons. No one is allowed to have them under international law. And that's allowed us to eliminate chemical and biological weapons from any serious state threat.
Given the statements by the Iranian president denying the Holocaust and his other these other views that he's expressed, does the president have international support for his current position in
Yes, and seeking
to stop Iran from developing these weapons?
There's been international condemnation of what Iran did yesterday. I don't know of any country that sent a congratulatory telegram. Russia, one of its closest friends, the country that's making a couple of billion dollars building the nuclear reactor at Bushehr, condemned this, said it was a step in the wrong direction. The head of the IAEA is in Tehran today, you know, saying, okay, you've done it, you made your point, now stop. So it doesn't have a lot of support for that, and there is, I think, support for stronger action. The problem is the U.S. has a major credibility and legitimacy problem here. People don't trust us. A lot of countries are afraid that they're being set up again. They don't want to see the United Nations used as a staging ground for another military adventure. So, ironically, by talking about military options, by not ruling them out the way, for example, Jack Straw, the foreign minister of England, has ruled out the military option, says there's no military option, period. By keeping them on the table, we ironically strengthen the hands of the hardliners in Iran who say, see, we can't satisfy these people. There's no pleasing them. Of course we have to go out and build a nuclear weapon. They say that, of course, sotto voce, softly, not publicly. And we scare our own allies. Russia and China are reluctant to go to stronger steps, sanctions, for example, for fear that that will justify U.S. military action. That's why I am completely convinced there is no military option here. We have to take it off the table. We have to start direct talks with the Iranians if we want to resolve this.
Last question before I bring in another voice, but you've told us where the U.S. is coming from. Where do you think the Iranians are coming from? What's driving this on the Iranian side, this quest for a nuclear weapon on the Iranian side?
There's almost no question that this program, which they claim is peaceful, began as a weapons program. Remember, the Shah had a nuclear program. We supported it then, even when our intelligence told us he was secretly working on the nuclear weapons. The Ayatollahs shut it down. But they restarted it in 1985 during the war with Iraq.
Did they shut it down in response to international pressure?
No.
They had other priorities?
Ideological. In 1979, they took power and they shut down the reactor that the West Germans were then building at Bushehr with U.S. blessing and said, this is Western technology. We want no part of it. We have our own course. They restarted in 85. It's unlikely they were thinking about nuclear power in 85. So that's suspicion number one. Suspicion number two, this whole program is out of sync. They're building an enrichment facility to make their own fuel. Countries with nuclear reactors don't make their own fuel. Only a few do this. The rule of thumb is you need to have 20 reactors before it makes any economic sense to have your own fuel plant. Their fuel plant is coming ahead of their reactor, their very first reactor. So that makes us suspicious, plus some other evidence. But right now, I believe that there isn't a hidden, covert nuclear weapons program. I don't believe they're racing to the bomb the way Iraq did, or for that matter, Israel did. I believe they're trying to acquire their technology openly and legally, and this is going to be hard to stop them, you see. This is actually more cunning than a secret program, so that they can be in a position some 5 or 10 years hence to make a bomb should they decide to do so, because the problem is the very same facilities that can enrich uranium for fuel can enrich them for a nuclear bomb. And once you have them, you have them. And at any point, Iran could then leave the treaty and say, you know what? We have to go make a nuclear weapon. You forced us into it. That's the challenge. How do we stop them from acquiring that capability?
I want to bring in another voice here. Michael Rubin is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He also joins us in Studio 3A. Welcome, Mr. Rubin.
Thank you.
A couple of the same questions to you. I want to get your take on that. First of all, what do you think is driving this in Iran?
In Iran, it's internal politics, which really matters, and ideology as well. The Islamic Republic has now been in existence for 26 years. It's been about 26 years since the revolution. And many of the Iranian people have lost faith in their government. When phone polls are done, or anecdotal evidence by journalists and so forth, what people pretty much figure out is about 80% of Iranians have lost faith in the concept of theocracy, which underpins the regime. Now, a lot of people would talk about reformers versus hardliners and hope that there could be some sort of muddle-through transition. But if you're the people at the top, the real theocrats, the real ideologues, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, who is actually above the president in the Iranian power structure, you're not going to give up your power. Now, if you have nuclear weapons, not only can you play the nationalist card among your people, but you also have a deterrent so that if you do have any sort of cedar revolution, rose revolution, orange revolution, you can use domestic security forces to crack down without fear of external interference. I was in Tehran in 1999 when the Turkish Air Force accidentally, in quotes, bombed Piranshahr, which is an Iranian border town near where there were PKK, these Kurdish terrorist camps from which people would go and attack Turkey. Now, the Turkish Air Force said it was an accident, but the Iranian government took the hint and stopped supporting terrorism. The point being that if Iran has a deterrent, no one could react to some of its actions against its own people or externally when it tries to export revolution or conduct terrorism.
We're talking about Iran. A day after Tehran claimed to have joined the nuclear club, what now? Is military action on the table? Should it be? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. We're talking about Iran this hour and weighing the options. Iran claims they're close to completing the nuclear fuel cycle, and the U.S. and European policymakers are puzzled about how to proceed. Our guests are Joseph Cirincione, he's with the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, and Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And before the break, Michael Rubin, you were telling us that you believe that in part what's driving this interest in nuclear weaponry is internal politics. If that's the case, should the rest of the country be, is this really a crisis? I mean, does Iran really have a history of aggression toward its neighbors such that they're developing a nuclear weapon really takes it to the crisis level?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, we're talking about the Islamic Republic leadership. We're not talking about the vast majority of the Iranian people who really have no say. And when it comes to the Islamic Republic, part of the issue is ideological. Now, some people will come back and say, well, Iran can actually be quite pragmatic. But there's a tendency for it to be pragmatic more along its borders. For example, it supports Christian Armenia against Shiite Azerbaijan. It also is dealing with Russia and being quiet on Chechnya. But there's also a component to the ideology which makes people worry. First of all, they could very well mean what they say. Can we risk that they don't? Within the Revolutionary Guards, there's a unit called the Quds Force, which is charged with export of the revolution. Likewise, while some people said all this talk that Saddam made about Kuwait's right to exist back in July 1990, that was just for domestic consumption, and it turns out it was wrong. So part of this is the real unknown factor. Would they do it? And again, would the ideologues, would the Revolutionary Guards, would the people like Ahmadinejad do it? And the last factor is there's been a troubling trend in President Ahmadinejad's rhetoric that calls upon this concept of the hidden imam, the Shiite messianic figure that's supposed to come back at the end of time, at the end of days, to usher in a just government. Now, in his United Nations speech and other talks, there's been a trend that suggests that he believes that through violence, perhaps, that the hidden imam can return. Most Iranians wouldn't say this, but the question is, does he mean this? Is he like us, or are there other factors guiding his logic?
I know both of you want to talk about options that the U.S. needs to consider or is considering, but before we do that, I want to go to a caller in St. Louis. And Charlie, what's on your mind?
I'd like to establish a little bit of credibility. I've lived in Iran. I've traveled there several times. Last time was 2 years ago. Most of my friends are Iranian. I believe if we were to attack Iran, it would be the worst mistake we've made since 1953 when we backed the Shah and overthrew Mossadegh. Iran is our best friend. I'm not talking about the government. I'm talking about the people, our best friend in the Middle East. And if we drop one bomb and kill one of those boys, it's going to change that irreversibly. I believe that firmly. Everyone asks me, hey, Charlie, what do you think about Iran? I think we're making a huge mistake. This could be the beginning of World War III.
Okay, Charlie, thank you so much for your call.
No problem.
Michael Rubin. And it speaks to your point. Charlie's point is that the Iranian people are far more interested and supportive of the West than the leadership is. And what this would do is galvanize public opinion. What do you think?
I would fully agree with his description of the Iranian people. I've also lived in Iran. My doctorate's in Iranian history. The calculation which American policymakers are making is everyone accepts that military action would have extremely high costs. Iran could lash out. There's no doubt that Iranian government, which isn't popular among most of the people, would rally people around the flags. Iranians are extremely nationalistic. The question that policymakers are considering is, would the cost of the Islamic Republic with nuclear weapons be even higher? One of the reasons why I personally oppose this idea of making a grand bargain with the Islamic Republic is because I'll look at 1953 and I'll look at 1979 when the U.S. government supported an unpopular government against the will of the Iranian people, and I don't want to make the same mistake three times. That said, the two options aren't just diplomacy and military action. There's a whole host of other actions which the U.S., Europe, and others could engage in which aren't violent, wouldn't kill Iranian boys, and which I think in this case I'll criticize the Bush administration. We've gone 5.5 years without a cogent policy, and we've squandered time that we could have used to implement some of these other strategies like a Gdansk model or something.
Well, give me an example and please tell me. I don't know what a Gdansk model is, so give me an idea of what some of the other options are, and then, Joe, I'd like to hear from you on that as well.
Well, I had the honor last August and last September of attending the 25th anniversary celebrations of the Solidarity Movement in Gdansk, Poland. And I had actually brought some Iranian student leaders to meet with Lech Walesa, the leader of the movement at the time. Now, not just in Iran, but throughout the Middle East, a lot of governments have gotten good at talking about civil society and using the term, but in reality, you have this debate between NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and what I would call GONGOs, government-operated non-governmental organizations. Now, the real problem in Iran is that the Iranian government doesn't represent the people. If you support independent labor unions, if you can somehow make the Iranian government more accountable to the people, then the Iranian government has to concentrate on other ways to spend its money than on this nuclear program.
But how does the U.S. do that? I mean, how does an outside entity make that government more accountable to its own citizens?
Well, in this case, it becomes a matter of helping train, helping support, and perhaps helping fund, if they want the funding, independent labor unions. You know, there was just a bus driver strike in Tehran, an independent bus driver strike. There's also been strikes in the Iranian papers have reported on this among textile workers up near the Caspian Sea and so forth. And when you look back at the Islamic Revolution in 1979, what ultimately brought down the government was a series of labor unrest that paralyzed the Shah.
Interesting. Joseph Sunciani, options?
Well, I'm glad that Michael and I agree that the Bush administration policy over the last 5 years has been a complete failure. Now, let's, you know, spread the blame around. The Clinton administration didn't exactly do a stellar job on this either. It's just that the Bush administration came in saying they wanted to make a fundamental break with the past. They had a new strategy on how to deal with this, and their answer was not to try to eliminate weapons through treaties, but try to eliminate regimes through direct action. So they targeted Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. The invasion of Iraq was the first implementation of this theory. It was all supposed to sort of fall like dominoes. Michael's colleague, Josh Moravchik at the American Enterprise Institute, said that we'd have a democratic tsunami that would sweep through the region. And a lot of people in this administration have been fixated on this idea we're going to solve the problem by overthrowing the regime. And this has just paralyzed us.
Okay,
this is why we're not talking to Iran. I mean, why aren't we talking to Iran? We talk to North Korea. We talk to Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And that's why I'm glad that this these articles have come out. The Cy Hirsch article, I think, has done a great service by taking this talk about military option from the back rooms and green rooms of Washington and bringing it into the public discourse. What do? You do what the Prime Minister of Germany just advised us to do. The conservative Prime Minister of Germany last week said, U.S., you've got to start talking to the Iranians. It isn't accept a nuclear Iran or attack them. The third choice is diplomacy. Let's start doing what the president says we want to do. Let's have a diplomatic track with Iran. We don't have it right now.
Let's go to Portland, Oregon, and Tupper. Tupper, what's on your mind?
I was just wondering. We've been through 40-some-odd years of Cold War with the Soviet Union with that threat of nuclear annihilation, basically, and if we let this, Iran develop a nuclear weapon, doesn't the threat of retaliation, if they use it, have some kind of bearing in this?
I think so. Thank you for that question. I think deterrence is alive and well. And the real danger, if worse comes to worse and Tehran gets a nuclear bomb, will they attack us or attack Israel? I don't think so. They understand that would be the last thing they ever did. The retaliation, even if conventional means alone, would end that regime. The real problem is what happens in the region. If Iran gets a nuclear weapon, what does Saudi Arabia do? A rival of Iran. What does Turkey do? What does Egypt do? A country that used to have a nuclear program and stopped it to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty. What the fear is, you could set off a nuclear reaction chain in the region where you'd go from a region with one nuclear power, Israel, to one with two, three, or four nuclear powers and the unresolved political, ethnic, and territorial disputes.
But you're saying
that's a recipe for nuclear war.
You're saying we need to talk to Iran. What should we be saying? Well, I mean, it's a wealthy country. What does the U.S. have to offer? What, economic development?
The Europeans have put a lot of carrots out on the table, mostly economic carrots. But what the Iranians really need is the carrot that only we can give, which is a security guarantee. We should make to Iran the same offer that successfully worked with Muammar Gaddafi. Muammar Gaddafi's nuclear program is over. It's in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It didn't cost us anything, and nobody died. That model works a lot better than the Iraq model. We should say, if you resolve our issues, which include the nuclear program, include your support for terrorism, and include your relationship to Israel, we're willing to recognize your regime. We're willing to guarantee that we will not continue efforts to try and overthrow your regime. Now, that's a pill that many in this administration don't want to swallow. We've swallowed it with North Korea. We've given that to North Korea. We gave it to Muammar Gaddafi. Why can't we give it to Iran? We now know that Iran has approached us several times in the past few years, including in April 2003, with an offer to have exactly these kinds of talks. There's indications they want to have them now. Why won't we talk?
Michael Rubin, is the IAEA an effective entity here, the United Nations? Are those effective entities for having these discussions, or is there another entity that should be at the forefront here?
The IAEA has been effective to a degree. And there's no doubt that much of the intelligence which decision makers, policy makers are utilizing is intelligence that was garnered through the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency process. There are a couple problems, however. First of all, when Mohammed al-Baradei, the director of the IAEA, says there's no proof that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, the devil's in the details. And the way the IAEA, in this case Mohammed al-Baradei, defines proof would be discovery of components, nuclear weapons components. By that point, it's a little bit too late for policymakers both in Europe and the United States. The other issue is that the IAEA is able to confirm what the declared program, but it's not able to really inspect the undeclared program. And the last issue, and this is to see the forest through the trees, where this problem got started was that the Islamic Republic of Iran signed the additional protocol to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, but hasn't ratified it. So, and what when you sign the program, what the additional protocol, you allow additional technology sharing. That was the sweetener. And when you ratify it, you allow much more robust inspections. And so when in Europe, in the United States, the basic demand is ratify this agreement. Don't act unilaterally. Do what other members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty have done.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joseph Cerciani, do you agree that the IAEA has been an effective entity, or do you really think that this calls for just bilateral talks between the U.S. and Iran?
I think it's been effective in giving us a lot of information about the Iranian program, but it hasn't been effective enough, which is why I support the part of the administration policy, which is to see if we can't get a resolution at the U.N. Security Council to grant the IAEA stronger inspection authority, not just for Iran. You can make it a generic resolution. So in any case where a country is suspected of violating its treaty obligations, the IAEA should be able to have more forceful, more comprehensive inspections, more along the scale of what we were doing in Iraq before the war. But the IAEA is an instrument. It can't solve this problem. It gives us information. Military strikes are an instrument. They can't solve this problem. This is a political problem. The U.S. has made a strategic determination that it cannot tolerate a nuclear-armed Iran. Iran has made, apparently, a calculation that says perhaps only nuclear weapons can protect us from the U.S. That's a clash of strategic imperatives. That will get you into a war. So if we don't want to go there, then we've got to open up negotiations to see if we can find a compromise on these imperatives. Can we give Iran the security guarantees it needs? Can we get the guarantees we need to make sure that whatever they're doing in a nuclear is purely peaceful and will not lead them to the capability of having a nuclear weapon, not just the intention of having a nuclear weapon?
Michael Rubin, I see you shaking your head here.
Easier said than done. Part of the problem in Iran is that the president, the diplomats, the foreign ministry doesn't have the ability to really negotiate. The supreme leader and the office of the supreme leader is the power center in Iran. They have absolute veto power over everything. Now, hopefully a diplomatic solution would work. I'm not sure whether speaking softly and carrying a big carrot has been successful. This isn't just a matter of threat of an Iranian perceived threat by the United States, because the nuclear program long predates the intervention in Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, and so forth. When you talk to ordinary Iranians, they're actually much more concerned about Pakistan, because the Pakistanis, when they tested their nuclear weapon, did so on the border. But we have tried to talk to Iran before, and every time we try to talk to Iran, the factions within the Iranian government end up blowing up in our face. 3 days after we were in November 4th, 1979, the Iranian students seized our embassy. That was 3 days after a meeting in Algiers about reestablishing relations. While the Iran-Contra affair is remembered mostly for the scandal in the United States, it really was an attempt to sort of break the ice with Iran in certain regards, and it wasn't leaked by Americans. It wasn't leaked by Cy Hirsch. It was leaked by actually people involved with Rafsanjani, who were in a power struggle with Ayatollah Khomeini's deputy's nephew. And so in this case, we've got to be very, very careful, and all issues have to be on the table. The April 2003 supposed Iranian deal is being mischaracterized in the press from what it actually was about.
Can I ask Michael a question?
You certainly can, briefly, sure.
One of my concerns is that the problem here is that the nuclear issue is being used as sort of the justification for a program to overthrow the Iranian regime. So I want to know about what you think, Michael, because you at AEI have been some of the harshest proponents, harshest critics of Iran. If we could resolve the nuclear issue and the terrorism issue and the recognition of Israel, would that be enough for you? Or do you feel that the real issue is the nature of the regime itself, that what we have to do is overthrow this regime? What's your position on this?
Michael Rubin is going to answer that after we come back from a short break.
Good teaser.
More on nuclear weapons and Iran. Where will all the rhetoric lead? I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. Some of the top stories we're following here at NPR News. Prosecutors have rested their case in the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. Before they did, jurors heard a recording of the final minutes of Flight 93 and saw photos of nearly all the 9/11 victims. also. FEMA officials released new guidelines for rebuilding in flood-damaged parts of New Orleans. Many of the city's homes will have to be raised 3 feet to qualify for federal flood insurance. You can hear details on both of these stories today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, it's no secret that Washington runs on secrets. But who says what is actually classified? Is too much information protected in the name of national security or not enough? That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking about Iran's nuclear ambitions. Is military action inevitable or is a diplomatic solution more likely? Our guests are Joseph Cirincione with the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, also Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And before the Greg, Joseph Cirincione, you had a question for Michael Rubin. Would you briefly remind us what it was?
I do. I wanted to ask Michael this. Michael, for you, what's the problem? Is it the nuclear program or the regime? That is it the program that you want to end, or is it the key for you to overthrow the regime as part of an effort to remake the geopolitical structure of the Middle East?
I don't know where that last part came from, but the problem is this regime with nuclear weapons threatening to use it. Now, both Clinton and Bush administration policy has been pretty consistent on what it means with regard to Iranians' weapons programs and the regime, and whether or not the United States would talk with the Iran. And what our main concerns, which have been consistent, are is Iranian violent opposition to the peace process, Iranian sponsorship of terrorism, Iran's weapons of mass destruction program, human rights and democracy. And what the policy is that we are willing to sit down with Iran if all issues are on the table, instead of just one or two, instead of just Iranian concerns. They have to address our concerns as well. And the other problem is the credibility of the partner. Is Iran sincere in its negotiations, or is it trying to run down the clock? Between 2000 and 2005, European Union trade with Iran almost tripled during the period of engagement and diplomacy. Iran, and that was the period of the reformist control inside Iran. That money didn't trickle down. It was invested into the weapons program. And so this is where sincerity of the partner becomes an issue. Sure, diplomacy should be given a try, but it's negligent to do it if you don't think your partner is being completely forthright and sincere.
So would it be okay to open up direct talks with Iran now?
If the talks involved all issues,
okay,
not just one, not just Iranian concerns,
understood, but there's
but
no
Americans, and Iran and the Office of the Supreme Leader
right.
have made clear that they're not willing to put all issues of concern on the table. But at the same time, we shouldn't make the mistake we made in 1953
right.
and 1979 of basically putting out a lifeline to an unpopular regime. The way I always try to think about this is what I would call the political prisoner test. If you take someone like Ahmed Bitebi or Arash Sigarchi, who are in Evin prison in Tehran for their political beliefs, for having been photographed on the cover of The Economist with a bloody shirt, do you want their interrogator coming in and saying, see, even the Americans are against you now, if we don't think that that negotiated tract is actually going to bring a solution
right.
to our concerns?
This is where it gets right. So, look, clearly this is a despicable regime. These people have killed dissidents in their bedrooms in Paris. These are not nice people. So, but we negotiate with not nice people. We negotiated with Stalin, with Mao, with Brezhnev, with Kim Jong-il, with Muammar Gaddafi. Is there something Do you fear that negotiations with them would somehow legitimize the regime? Do you have that concern? Because some in the government have raised that.
Well, with Muammar Gaddafi, and I'll answer your question in a second, the British, who put out the first feelers, had to wait 3 years before they were able to determine that the negotiators were actually speaking on behalf of Muammar Gaddafi and that Muammar Gaddafi would do what the negotiators said. At the same time, during the Camp David II process with Bill Clinton, the main problem was that the Palestinian negotiators were negotiating, but Yasser Arafat wasn't accepting what many of his negotiators told him. So this is the problem. Ultimately, I would say let's side with the Iranian people. No one wants to invade Iran. That's a straw man argument, if I've ever heard one. You're not making that. Others have. Military strikes are a last resort, but there's no reason why we shouldn't reach out to Iranian civil society, which is actually what the State Department's doing with its $75 million.
Joseph Cirincione, you had the first word, so Michael Rubin, you're going to get the last word.
Wait a minute. He just had all these words. Okay, go ahead.
I think we'll revisit this topic. I'm sure that we will. So I want to thank you both, Joseph Cirincione, Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Come on, set an example.
Thank you
very much.
Be peaceful. It was a pleasure.
And Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you.